It's another chilly day here in the Flathead and other parts of Montana. A great day to be adding to the great programs that Tom has had recently on energy. And we'll be talking with Amanda Eversole of the API, American Petroleum Institute. We'll be unpacking its ideas on energy literacy, consumer choice, and the country's energy opportunities, maybe even what drill, baby drill might actually mean. And then it's always a good day to talk about our kids and their education. So we'll be talking about 4-day school weeks for kids, a movement we've seen started here in Montana, and some decisions to not go there. A team of University of Montana researchers will talk about a past study and also a follow-on report that's about to be released. I suspect it'll have some powerful conclusions. All of this today on Voices of Montana.
Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
Well, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to learn a lot. And by the way, I want to say happy Valentine's Day to everybody. And also, I want to say that it was great yesterday to have some folks texting in and also phoning in and having Cody relay some comments and questions. Keep them coming. So I noticed this morning before we went on the air on its Northwestern Energy real-time electricity generation chart that it was buying electricity for us overnight when the sun wasn't shining and the wind dropped. Hydro and coal generation remains steady. The wind's picked up a bit and the sun is beginning to shine. So they right now make up maybe 10% of the Northwestern Energy electricity mix. In the future, though, natural gas is going to be even more important as we see the Yellowstone Generating Station coming online for Northwestern Energy. So to visit a little bit about all of that, about natural gas and, of course, oil and our future energy mix, we'll be joined in just a minute by Amanda Eversole. Amanda is the Executive Vice President and Chief Advocacy Officer at the American Petroleum Institute, or API, joining API in 2018 as Chief Operating Officer. But before we get to her, I want to just mention a few things in her impressive background, because I think all of this bears on the conversation that we're going to have in just a minute. She's been Managing Director and Head of Public Affairs at J.P. Morgan Chase. She spent 13 years at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, including as President of its Technology Engagement Center. She has an MBA from the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. So our guest is really exceptionally qualified to look at energy policy from a national perspective involving resources, economics, consumer demand, and the environment, but also from a global perspective of competitiveness in an increasingly high-tech world in which many people still don't have basic energy needs like electricity. So, Amanda, I want to welcome you to the program. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you.
Well, and let's start with just a few words about API. Can you share what it does?
Of course. Of course, we're a national trade association, and for those listeners that don't know what trade associations are, we have about 600 members, companies that join API, ranging from very large global integrated oil and gas companies to very small businesses, mom-and-pop shops that work in and around this industry and provide services and supplies and technologies. And our job is to do two things. We advocate on behalf of a strong environment for natural gas and oil to continue to provide an important role for the American people. And the second thing is we develop standards for operational safety and environmental protection to keep our people, our communities, safe. And we do that both here in the United States, and we also do it in 140 countries around the world.
And we want to talk a little bit more about all of that, but I think here in Montana, it's important for our listeners to remember that we do have oil and gas operations. We've got a regional refining center down in Billings and Laurel. We've got another refinery in Great Falls that's doing some pretty amazing things with biofuels as well as with oil. And we, of course, have infrastructure. We use natural gas in Montana as well as lots of gasoline because we drive long distances here. And so API seems to cover all of those sectors. Is that a fair assessment?
That is absolutely right. We cover from the time that we find ways to get it safely and efficiently out of the ground, transport it to where it needs to be refined, and then make sure that it gets turned into finished products safely and efficiently, and then on to the consumer.
Well, it's an important time for you to be talking about all this, because we know here in Montana and across the country that sometimes energy literacy is a bit lacking, and so we'll want to get your thoughts on some of that. In fact, one of the things that I wanted to get into a little bit was on the 5th of this month, you testified before, I think it was the Energy Subcommittee of the House. And you made some very interesting points about a number of things that API is involved in, but really that are challenges for the country. What basically was the principal message that you tried to get across to the members of that subcommittee?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the question. You know, what the context of the hearing was about ways to unleash American energy. And I think the reality that a lot of people don't really think about every day is that the demand for energy here in Montana, here in the United States, and around the world is growing a lot. So there gets to be these arguments around kind of what's the cool form of energy that at that moment in time. But what the debate often fails to realize is that the overall size of that pie, for example, is growing a lot. And so the context of the hearing was, we need to figure out how we do it here in America, because energy produced here is affordable, reliable, and safer, and helps really protect us from a national security perspective. And so API has a 5-point policy roadmap where we have concrete ideas of how to do just that, ensure that American energy is part of the solution going forward. And I think so often in this political environment, you know, everybody focuses on why you can't do something or the reason why the opposing view is wrong. And, you know, we really wanted to challenge that conventional wisdom and say, hey, look, there is a lot of very constructive things that we can do that should be bipartisan in nature. And so we put some solutions on the table, and we look forward to working with Republicans and Democrats to do just that. Like, protect consumer choice. We don't think that there should be mandates around what sort of vehicle you drive or what sort of stove you have in your house. We don't think that we should ban natural gas exports. It helps our allies. It also helps create jobs here in the United States. We also know that we need to be able to build stuff in this country. It takes way too long to get shovels in the ground if you can ever do it. And it really just doesn't have to be that way. And so we look forward to just good common sense solutions while respecting the environment to get things done for the American people.
Well, Amanda, I think you're cutting out just a little bit there, but I wanted to really pursue some of these items that you just mentioned and want to come back to them. But how do you respond when people hear oil and hear gas and they repeat the negatives of fossil fuels in a world where there is climate change, of course, happening, and some would think that there isn't a real role for oil and natural gas in the mid- or long-term future? How do you answer that?
Sure thing. And why don't I just give a check on this? I'm on my landline, but is this line okay? Am I cutting in and out?
I think you're sounding good now.
Okay. Yep. All right. Sorry about that. The debate over climate change is a really complicated one that gets infused with rationally data, but also a lot of emotion. And API very much acknowledges the fact that the climate is changing and that man has an impact on the climate. We also believe that we're part of the solution. And, you know, I sort of step back to the big picture, which is, What is our objective? And if the objective is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the atmosphere, then we should figure out how to maximize the reduction of the GHGs for the minimum cost to society. And there's a whole bunch of solutions to do that. There are, however, a lot of groups who kind of purport to be, pro-environment, who really, their objective is really to stop the use of fossil fuels. And that's a very different That's a very different objective. And from our perspective, natural gas is the single biggest driver of how the U.S. has led the world in emissions reductions over the last generation. And that's really kind of switching from higher emitting fuels to natural gas. And what we see is really an attempt to demonize certain types of energy. But what it fails to recognize, Bill, is that there are still 750 million people on this planet that don't have reliable access to electricity. And that is really limiting. And, you know, I think a lot of people, when we get into climate debates, start from a certain perspective. From my perspective, energy, and oil and gas in particular, has done more to improve the human condition than virtually any industry in the history of humanity. And importantly, we have some of the best brains on the planet who know how to optimize molecules, and it is incumbent on us to help in solving the challenges brought about by climate change. And we are committed to doing just that.
Well, that's a proactive and, I think, forward-looking point, because as I look around my desk right here, I don't think there's a single thing I see that really either didn't have a petrochemical, an oil or a gas component, or that didn't come here to Montana because we were able to bring it on a truck or a train. And so it really is kind of an important thing to kind of keep in mind as we talk about energy literacy and securing American energy leadership, as I think you said in your testimony. Let's go through some of the points in your five-point plan, and let's see how they resonate. And we'll have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but then we'll come back and do some more. So first of all, consumer choice. Are you saying that that Americans ought to be able to have whatever forms of energy are available to them? Or what is that point in more detail?
Sure. The Biden administration in particular, and some states like the state of California and about a dozen others that follow in lockstep with the regulations that California promulgates, have required what they refer to as zero emission vehicles by a date certain. And so just in a couple of years, there is what is in fact an EV mandate, an electric vehicle mandate for certain states and from the Biden administration for the United States. And what we are already seeing is that car manufacturers are having to change what their future product lines are as a consequence. We also see that the American people are not choosing to buy these vehicles. Now, let me be very clear, Bill. API supports free markets. And so if somebody wants to go and buy these vehicles, by all means, that's what this country is about, consumer choice. But forcing Americans to particularly purchase a technology where they may not have access to charging stations, they may have to travel long distances. We know that batteries deplete more in cold weather. Certainly Montanans know about that. It just may not be the right fit. And so we are clearly calling on the Trump administration to repeal what the so-called tailpipe regulations, because we don't think that heavy-handed mandates, and whether it's your vehicle or whether it's the stove in your house or whether it's your furnace, we don't think that heavy-handed mandates are what the American people want. And frankly, I think that's what the American voters told us in November. It was just a full rejection of these heavy-handed mandates going forward.
Amanda, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back and keep going down your list of points. We'll be back right after this. Well, we're back. We're back with Amanda Eversole, Executive Vice President of the API. And Amanda, very interesting topics here. One of the things that you mentioned was, of course, the consumer product choice approach of the API. And when consumers are picking their types of devices, cars, or choices of types of energy to heat or cool their homes, that implies that we have to be able to use all of our natural resources, the ones that make sense for various types of applications. And I think that's one of your points, too, that you made to the subcommittee, if I'm not mistaken.
It sure is. America is blessed with an abundance of natural resources across a very broad range of a spectrum. And oil and gas is one of those areas. And when we think about the ability to have American energy, not only does it support 11 million jobs, many including in the state of Montana, but it also helps drive economic benefit. But at the end of the day, it helps keep the country safe. And I know your son has served with great distinction in the United States military. I'm a military spouse. And what I know is that by leveraging our natural resources, it helps keep our country safe and our allies abroad. And so let me give you an example. In the offshore, particularly in now what we refer to as the Gulf of America, there is offshore oil and gas production, and it is among the most efficient and the cleanest produced in the entire world. And last year was the first year since 1966 that there wasn't a single lease sale offered by the previous administration. And the problem with that is that we're in a depletion business. Once we drill a well or once we are up in production, right, you have less and less production as a consequence. And so we always have to be thinking about where are our next raw materials. And about 25% of our production is on federal lands and in federal waters. And so we need to have policies that allow that industry to go and safely and responsibly extract resources because it benefits the American consumer after all.
So, Amanda, one of the things that some politicians have said in the past, and thankfully I think we've kind of turned a corner on this, but they warn that, well, we're going to run out someday. How do you view this peak oil or this mentality that we are going to run out? Do you think it'll be any time that we can foresee?
Well, this debate has been going on around predictions of peak oil since longer than I've been alive. And it turns out nobody has been right yet. And so my perspective is the engineers, those scientists that are involved in figuring out not only how to efficiently leverage technology to discover additional oil and gas, but just think back. It's only been about 15 years ago when we as a country experienced the shale revolution. Not long ago, we were a net energy importer. We relied on energy from foreign sources. Now, today, we are a net energy exporter, both in oil and in natural gas, and that is really a consequence of innovations and technology like, for example, hydraulic fracturing. It's allowed us to access resources and raw materials that we either didn't know existed or that weren't technically feasible to extract. And so the question of, well, when is it going to run out? Well, 15 years ago, we were in a very different position than we are today. And what I know is that when I think about where the best and brightest minds are in terms of not only being able to optimize molecules, but being able to make sure that we responsibly are able to access these materials, they're in the oil and gas industry. And so I would bet long on the industry in terms of being able to use more efficient processes to get more out of the wells that we have. And you see, for example, one of the things that people talk about a lot is the rig count in the United States. Well, the rig count has sort of stayed flat or gone down, and that's not because we're producing less. In fact, we are producing record amount of oil and gas in this country, but we are doing it more efficiently, and we can also reach farther distances horizontally by horizontal drilling underneath the ground, which again allows us to be efficient and allows us to not disrupt the environment above the ground as well.
And I think many listeners may want to be reminded that here in Montana, we have Montana Tech, one of the schools that turns out petroleum and environmental and other engineers that are in high demand in the oil and gas businesses, as I understand it, as does the Montana State University turn out some really wonderful high-tech engineers and others that might want to take a look at jobs in the oil and gas sector, huh?
Absolutely. Some of the best and brightest minds, including some of the leaders of our companies, have been educated through your universities. And what I would say to those listeners that may be thinking about a new opportunity or coming out of high school or thinking about what they're doing in college, you know, my view is that this industry has some of the most amazing opportunities to genuinely change the world from the perspective of how do we continue to do more with American energy to not only help the American consumer here in the United States, but there's a national security component and there's a component of we can do it all while we figure out how to continue to reduce emissions. And these are big global challenges, and that's why we need the best and the brightest coming to work with us.
Well, Amanda, we have about a minute and a half left before we have to cut you loose, and this has been fascinating. I can already tell we're going to have you back at some point. But of the other points that we haven't talked about, is there one you might want to just briefly mention so that we don't overlook it?
Well, I think I'd hit on two things. The first is, you know, we need to be able to get permits in this country because right now it takes way too long to build things, And then there's a legal component of it. Pretty much anyone, anywhere, anytime can sue to stop a project. They may not win, but they win by delaying things. And this is a real problem. We need a shot clock. We need to be able to just do things right, make sure that we jump through the appropriate hoops, but we need to be able to get shovels in the ground. And the second thing is tax reform. Tax reform is really important to the industry because we are huge capital investors in the United States. This helps jobs. It helps. It helps the workforce. But again, if we don't have some clarity and continuity in the way in which we invest our capital, you know that keeps some money on the sidelines, and that's not a great thing. So for your listeners, I might suggest if they want to learn more about energy, if they want to learn more, I would commend lightsonenergy.com. This is an energy literacy site that API sponsors. And it has a lot of facts about energy that I think are helpful as people think about just how energy impacts your daily lives. And if anybody wants to take action, I would commend them to energycitizens.org. Energy Citizens are a great way for your listeners to speak up and say American energy is important. And for that, we would be very, very grateful, Bill.
Well, Amanda, thank you for joining us. As I said, I think there's a good chance we'll have you back before too long because the energy subject here in Montana and across the nation and around the world, it seems to me, is even more important because of the items that you've mentioned, the need for choice and geopolitical strength and all of those things. So I want to thank you again for spending time with us. I thank you for the work that you and your colleagues do. In a world where there are many sources of energy, we're going to need them all, I suspect, over the long term. And thank you for doing your part.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you and your listeners today, Bill.
Thanks again. Well, in just a moment, we're going to be changing subjects to the four-day school week. Now, this is a movement that has taken parts of the country by, I don't want to say storm, but by interest. And even in parts of Montana, but some school districts are rejecting that notion. In fact, our own Big Fork School District was very recently one of those that rejected the shorter school week. And one of the school board members mentioned the persuasiveness of a University of Montana subject study on that very, very issue. Now, in just a few minutes, we're going to have Drs. Dan Lee, the Dean of the College of Education at UM, Erica Allen, John Matt, Bill McCaw, and Lakeen Tang join us, and they'll be talking a little bit about their previous study about the four-day school week and also a new one that's about to be released very soon. I think you'll find it absolutely fascinating, and we'll learn more about education of our kids.
Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
Well, this is Bill Whitsitt filling in for Tom for just this one more day. And we're back with members of the UM College of Education research team that's been looking at questions around proposals to cut school weeks for students to 4 days. And I want to say welcome to all of you. This is probably the largest group that we've had on the program since I've been filling in for Tom. And I'll just encourage you to identify yourselves if you're answering part of the question and get close to that phone. So, but again, welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
And let's start by kind of setting the ground here. What is the situation in Montana? Do we have a lot of school districts that have adopted the 4-day school week?
Hi, Bill. This is Dr. Erica Allen. And currently, at the time of our study, we had 141 out of 429 school districts, so about 33%, who had already adopted the 4-day school week schedule. Since that time, there have been others who have adopted the schedule, and many others are starting to look at that.
So, nationwide and in Montana, what are some of the reasons that people give for wanting to go to the 4-day week?
You know, our study did not look at the reasons. However, in 2011, the OPI, Office of Public Instruction, completed a survey asking that question, and the answers were primarily attendance, teacher recruitment, financial cost savings. Those are the big three.
And so when you say attendance, was there a feeling, do you suspect, that maybe kids would attend school on a more regular basis if they had fewer days to go? I'm trying to understand that.
Yeah. Well, yes, you're right on that. And part of the reason, too, that parents thought that maybe they could take their students to doctor's appointments, dentist appointments, orthodontist appointments on Friday. Unfortunately, many doctors are not currently open and dentists on Friday, so that hasn't panned out.
And when we talk about the recruitment, I think, of teachers, is this a big selling point on teachers joining a school district, do you think?
You know, we looked at that in our second phase of the research, and we researched newly graduated students and asked them their preference for a 4-day and 5-day school week, and most teachers did prefer the 5-day week, the 4-day school week. However, when we looked at all of the districts and all the teachers in Montana, retention is higher in the 5-day school week. So that's where teachers are staying, is in the 5-day school week.
Well, let's now take a step back and talk a little bit more in depth about the first study that you've done. The first study, why was that done, or what were you asked to do that kind of a study, and how did it actually come about?
Yeah, OPI contacted us and asked if we were interested in the study, which we obviously were. They worked through our dean here, Dr. Lee, and they wanted kind of a global look at the 4-day school week. Back in 2014, the gentleman who is now chair of the Board of Public Ed did a study on achievement in the 4-day week and found that the schools in the 5-day week performed a lot better. So they were really wanting us to move forward and see if that was still the trend, and then also look at the other reasons that people went to the 4-day week, look at attendance and look at finance. So we went into that pretty deep. We actually were really grateful to the Office of Public Instruction, who provided us with a lot of data. And we actually counted up the data points that we had, and it was over 158 million data points, which gives us a really good view of all of the students and all of the school districts in the state. So we looked at go ahead, Bill.
I'm sorry, I was going to say, this is fascinating, and what were some of those specific points that you thought the data really pertained to best? I mean, what did you look at?
Yeah, so we started with finance. One of the reasons that people were going to the four-day week was we would save money. Okay, we looked at the per-student expenditures in the general fund, in maintenance, in transportation, and in food services. And across the board in general fund and in transportation and maintenance, school districts spent more on the four-day week on a per-student basis than in the five-day week. Now, there were some areas of savings, food services, for example. Well, they were feeding the kids one day less. So they did save money in food services. But if you're feeding them one day less, you also have one day less of revenue. So it probably balances out. But if districts went to it to save money, they didn't. And one of the things, Bill, about this study is we really looked at what happened. And we looked at it with all of the data that's available to us. So, you know, we didn't exclude school districts. We did everybody. The next thing we looked at was achievement. And we looked at achievement in a lot of different ways. First of all, a straight comparison. If you're in a four-day week, what's your percentage of proficient? If you're in a five-day week, what's your percentage of proficient? And there was quite a large gap between the four-day week and the five-day week proficiency. And when they give us the scores for these, they give us for each student whether they are at a novice level, at approaching proficient, proficient, or advanced. So we grouped proficient and advanced together and called those students proficient. And we looked for each student, were they proficient or were they not proficient? And what's the level of proficiency then in the four-day week students and in the five-day week students? Then we went on and looked at the ACTs. And the ACTs were pretty amazing. There's a big difference in students who were in the four-day week versus the five-day week. And we looked at that longitudinally as well. So we looked at how long were the students in the four-day week. And the students in the that had just started in the four-day week had a significantly higher ACT score than those that were in it for 12 years. We looked at then what's happening trend-wise. So we looked at all of the school districts that started the four-day week in each of the years, starting in 2008. And we looked at the trend for those districts. And universally, over the course of the time they were in the four-day school week, their achievement decreased as a cohort. So after we finished with achievement, we went on and looked at attendance. And you would expect, like Dr. Ellen was talking about, that students would go to school more if they only had to go 4 days. And, you know, the idea was that, well, they'd do the sporting events and everything on Friday, and they wouldn't be missing school to go to those. And attendance was higher in the five-day week schools than in the four-day week schools. So the amazing thing to us is, you know, if you went for the money, you didn't save. If you went there for attendance, students didn't go to school more. And achievement was down for students in the four-day school week, and dramatically.
So how was your study received once it was put out there, once it was published? What was the reaction?
Well, the people that are in the five-day school week said, see, told you. And those that are in the four-day week didn't say a lot to us, honestly. We've had a lot of inquiries, though, from people who are looking at the four-day week, wanting information about it. We even had an inquiry out of Idaho that had gotten a hold of the study because they were looking at a four-day week.
Well, we just had a text come in. Somebody has asked or made a comment that four-day week may be great for teachers and save money. I think your study would refute that last point. But as a parent, this person says, I then have to spend money for childcare. Interesting. Have you had that kind of reaction to some extent?
I've heard that across the state, honestly. Victor was the first school district in the state to go to the four-day week back in 2006. And they set up a daycare system there at the school for parents. And it was kind of a money thing for the school. They brought in revenue from that. But it was also set up to be a service to justify them not having the fourth day or fifth day, excuse me.
Well, this is all fascinating, and we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I'd like to talk about now what you've done since and what the future looks like in terms of research in this area. So we'll be right back after this. We're back. Bill Whitsitt filling in for Tom Schultz, and I am just very pleased that we've got such a team of education researchers here that we're talking with about the four-day school week. Can you folks tell me now what is coming next? Do you have another study, do I understand correctly, that will be published soon, or is there more research in the works?
Yes, we've done a follow-up study now. We've called it Phase 2, which really took what we did in Phase 1 and disaggregated it. We disaggregated by gender and ethnicity. And very honestly, we found the same thing as in Phase 1, but there was gender-wise slightly more detrimental. The four-day week is slightly more detrimental to male students than it is to female. But we're not finding anything else in that study. Although in Phase 2, we looked at teacher retention. And teacher retention is a big issue. Recruitment, we found from the survey that we did that, as Erica said, teachers do prefer the four-day week. At least 80% of them did, and these were new teachers. They also said, though, that the number of days of the week was not a factor in their decision to select a job. But when we looked at teacher retention, and this, again, we had all of the data back to 2011 for all of the schools in the state. And we looked at teacher retention in the four-day week versus the five-day week. And we found that teacher retention is higher in the five-day week schools. And that was, we thought, possibly a factor of school size. Most of the districts are small schools that are on the four-day week. So we tested school size and found that there is a higher retention level in larger schools. So to compensate for that, we removed the large schools from the pool, and we looked at small schools on the four-day school week and small schools on the five-day school week, and we found the same thing. Teacher retention was higher in the five-day school week schools. Moving on forward then, we're looking at identifying some districts that may have had some marginal success in the four-day week. And we're looking at doing some case studies there to see what it is that separates those districts. We have five potential districts, and that's five that we found that have scored above the state average, but that's out of 141 school districts.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating. On that retention point, I'm particularly interested in that one. It may be in my mind that there are some teachers, too, that just fall in love with their students and their ability to help guide these students to successful lives. And so the more time with them, the better. Now, that's not scientific, right? But I would like to think that that may be a part of it.
But anecdotal, and, yes.
And,
you know, we look at what can be done about this. You know, and the challenge that school districts face with this is once they're in it, it's very hard to get out of it. Again, not part of the study, it's anecdotal, but I'm good friends with a lot of superintendents in the state because I was a superintendent for a long time here. And a lot of them that I talk to want out of this and don't know how to get out of it because they're going to be asking teachers and employees that are working 4 days a week to work a fifth day for no additional pay. And that's a tricky thing to do. So, you know, we see there's probably one solution to this that would work for everyone, which is if the legislature would go back to 180 days instead of 1,080 hours.
Well, very interesting. And have you talked to folks at the Capitol about that?
No. We have talked to the Office of Public Instruction and to the Board of Public Ed.
Well, I think you've given all of us, parents, educators alike, some real interesting and important things to be thinking about because our kids are so important and we know in Montana, just across the country, that we're in an increasingly competitive world, and we need to do the best by them that we can. So I want to thank all of you for the work that you've done to date, the work you'll do in the future, and thank you for being with us. I have thoroughly enjoyed sitting in for Tom Schultz. Courtney Kibblewhite will be here on Monday and Tuesday, and I thank all of you who have been listening and sending in comments and questions, and I hope to be talking with you again soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.